We're turning back the clock today, November 1976. We're going to talk about the murder of Dallas police officer Robert Wood. Man, what a horrific murder it was. He's on patrol, pulls over a car for no headlights on, walks up to the car, and is immediately shot. Shot, I think, five times, or at least five shots fired before he even made it to the door of the car. Even the other officers of Dallas PD were a little bit critical of Officer Wood's partner, or at least they questioned where she might have been right when the incident happened. There was they just called it a chocolate substance on the ground, mm-hmm. You know, as if the milkshake had been thrown at some point. And I guess speculation would be either she was in the car and got out, or threw it out the window and got out to respond to the situation, or she was already out of the car, maybe drinking the milkshake, and when the shooting happened, she threw the milkshake and drew her gun.
The last thing that I would ever do would make my initial approach with my hands busy with an extra item in the ticket book. That's just not smart.
One of the detectives in the documentary says, hey, Christmas was approaching. We'd never had an unsolved police homicide go on this long, so pressure was mounting to make an arrest. And I think that played a little bit of a role in some of the events that happened down the road, right?
I think the pressure got to the police department, prosecutors, judge, community. He was just cold, matter of fact, very, very kind, almost charming in some of his interviews, but it just seemed like he was detached from the seriousness of the situation. In the documentary that we interviewed, that said that he had told them individually that he had killed a cop. It's strange behavior.
He claims that the detective draws his gun and points it at him and says, pick it up, and they have this standoff. He refuses to touch it. Mark, who knows if this is true or not? She gave this statement initially 15 minutes after the shooting, and then after the IA investigation, weeks later, where they had, quote, refreshed her recollection, the statement was completely different.
These are the worst witnesses I could imagine in this type of a case.
The Chief, 1976. Do you remember a song called Tonight's the Night by Rod Stewart? I know we were, I don't know, what were you, about 12 13 years old? What, 13?
Yes.
Tonight's the Night,
the song AM very transistor. Well.
Yeah. That was the, we're turning back the clock today, November 1976. We're going to talk about the murder of Dallas police officer Robert Wood. Man, what a horrific murder it was. And a little bit, you know, commentary on the justice system back then in general, and how this case was handled, and capital murder case, obviously, the conviction of a man. And we both watched a documentary, Mark, called Thin Blue Line, and that's what this podcast is about. And hey, folks, anytime you watch a documentary, you're getting the documentarian's side of the story. You're getting a side of the story. I don't know which side, but you're getting a side of the story, and you're getting a specific narrative. Did you do any research, Mark, outside of watching that documentary?
I just read an article about the documentary itself, and it kind of went into a little more detail about the motivations of the actual producer, Mr. Morris. So that was kind of interesting, what his original motivations were and how he kind of got, I won't say sidetracked, but how the tensions were drawn more to this murder than his original subject matter.
That's interesting, because I didn't see that, and I'm real curious to hear about that later. So, like I said, back in November 1976, a police officer named Robert Wood, he's on patrol, pulls over a car for no headlights on, walks up to the car, and is immediately shot. Shot, I think, five times, or at least five shots fired before he even made it to the door of the car. A gentleman named Randall Adams, eventually convicted of that murder in Texas, capital murder case. Interesting that Adams was a little bit of a drifter, and I guess to start the story with Adams, from Ohio, Adams and his brother decided at some point in time to move to California. And somehow their trip to California took them through Texas, which seems a little bit out of the way, but hey, free country, freedom to travel. Right. So Randall Adams and his brother passing through Dallas, eating breakfast one morning, and Randall Adams somehow at breakfast is offered a job and picks up a job in Dallas and ends up staying there for a while. I don't know where he's working. They don't say in the documentary, Mark, unless I missed it.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Yeah, we get to November and Thanksgiving weekend, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. He shows up to work and apparently no one showed up. And that's the statement he made. He said, I got to work, no one's there. I don't know what kind of place it was, how that happens, whatever. So he's driving back to a hotel, kind of like, what would you call it? Like an extended stay hotel or a month, weekly motel, Mark?
Yeah.
No-tell motel?
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he runs out of gas. He runs out of gas in his car. So he's walking down the side of the road with his gas can, and a kid named David Harris picks him up, a 16-year-old. Takes him to get gas. They gas up the car, and then David Harris follows Randall Adams back to the hotel where Randall's staying, and they buy beer and drink beer and smoke a little weed, and they go to a couple drive-in movies. And this is where the stories of the two men start to diverge, right?
Yep.
We can give Adams' account. Adams' account is real simple. I wasn't there. You know, Adams says he was dropped off at the hotel. That's all he knows. He wasn't in the car at the time of any shooting. He doesn't know what happened with any shooting. And he says it was Harris. Harris's account is that Adams was driving the car. And as they got pulled over for no headlights on, Harris was nervous. He was 16 years old. He was a kid. He crouched down in the seat. So it would appear that only one person was in the car. And he says that as Woods walked up on the car, Adams put the gun out the window and shot him 5 times and they sped off. So again, Adams says, wasn't even there, doesn't know anything about it. Harris says Adams was driving the car, Adams did the shooting, and Harris was kind of hiding, crouched down in the passenger seat, so it may have looked like there was only one person in the car.
I guess, and I may be going a little out of order here, Mark, so help me out if I am, but it turns out that David Harris had stolen a car from his next-door neighbor, yep. A blue Ford, what's it called, a Maverick or something like that?
You know what, I was just writing those
Mercury,
down myself.
Because Mercury Comet?
Yeah, I think it was a comet. I guess it was a person who was misidentified. Mercury. Now I'm getting ahead of the game here, but
Mercury steals a car. Now, 16 years old, steals a car from his neighbor, steals a couple guns from his dad, or takes a couple guns from his dad. And this is in Vidor, Texas, and he heads to Dallas where all this happens. So I guess what we, you know, it's real hard to say factually what happened at the traffic stop. I got a couple questions for you on this because a lot was made of the partner that was with Officer Woods, right? And again, this documentary was filmed in 1988 about a crime that took place in 76. So Woods had a female partner, one of the first female patrol officers that was with Dallas PD, actually out working a beat, I think.
I believe she was the first, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But you're right, at least one of the very, very first.
Now, so I know, obviously, Mark, you weren't Highway Patrol in 76 or 88, but pretty close to 88. In a two-man unit, right, back when you started, 1991, whatever it was, what would be the procedure for, you know, who would make contact? Where would the second officer be? Because I think even the other officers of Dallas PD were a little bit critical of Officer Wood's partner, or at least they questioned where she might have been when the incident happened, et cetera. So what when you started, what would the procedure have been for a two-man unit?
So before I get into what the procedure would be, this is a very interesting, although obviously it's an ancillary aspect to the overall story about the guilt or innocence of the players here. But it's very, very interesting about in the documentary about what her actions were at the time of the shooting, this traffic stop. And the documentary, to the best of my recollection, Bill, never really determines if anybody did, you know, in other words, if Faust PD or the DA or the defense attorneys, if anybody really determined exactly where she was at the time of the shooting and subsequently. We do know she fired several rounds at the bullet at the fleeing vehicle after the shooting. But we don't know for sure. Obviously, she testified that she got out, she did this, but we don't know if that's after the fact. Now she's trying to put herself within policy and procedure, or if it actually happened that way. So addressing what I was trained to do in a situation like this, so the Highway Patrol, I think like most agencies now around the country, but I think more so the Highway Patrol because the CHP is traffic oriented. Mm-hmm. We understand that traffic is actually statistically more deadly than the person in the vehicle. Again, statistically talking, mm-hmm. not on an individual basis. And so your first concern always has to be the subject or subjects in the vehicle. You have to make sure that is you have eyes on, and that is, as far as you're concerned, that situation stabilized. Subsequent to that, you have to be aware of traffic. Now, obviously, in the documentary, I'm not exactly sure where the stop was made. It was actually on a busy county road. You can't really tell for sure if it's on a local street, but either way, you want to avoid traffic. So especially on the freeway, the Highway Patrol, I was trained to make right side approaches because mm-hmm. you're more likely to be killed by a passing vehicle in the right lane than you are in the person you stop, but from the person that you stopped. It's just a statistical mm-hmm. fact. It doesn't mean that you disregard the danger of the subjects. You just have to control both environments. The your partner officer is to provide cover for you, to be the second set of eyes, primarily focused on the vehicle. And obviously for themselves and for you to scan, keep your head on a swivel for traffic as well. Mm-hmm. And that is what that officer, according to the documentary of articulating Dallas Police Department policy, was supposed to do as well, to provide mm-hmm. cover for that officer. Whether she did it or not, whether she got out of the car after the vehicle fled, I don't think anybody's ever going to know.
One thing that was interesting, and they mentioned it in the documentary, and I don't want to say they made a big deal of it, but was the milkshake. They had stopped at a fast food restaurant just prior, and she had purchased a chocolate milkshake. And then I saw a schematic of the crime scene drawn out, and you could see where they had noted on the ground next to or near the passenger side of the police vehicle, there was they just called it a chocolate substance on the ground. You know, mm-hmm. as if the milkshake had been thrown at some point. And I guess speculation would be either she was in the car and got out or threw it out the window and got out to respond to the situation, or she was already out of the car, maybe drinking the milkshake. And when the shooting happened, she threw the milkshake and drew her gun. Generally, you would hold a drinking cup and shoot with the same hand. That's, you know, I guess something that's speculating, but that's normally strong-handed. Whatever, you're right-handed, left-handed, that would generally be the hand you use to do both. So interesting. I know that, you know, the car sped off after the shooting, right, Mark? So hey, let me ask you something else, which wasn't an issue here. And by the way, he left his ticket book. Officer Wood left his ticket book in the car. I don't know if that's really indicative of anything. The documentary said that likely he was not even going to write a ticket. He was just going to tell them put their lights on, you know.
Please don't forget the point you wanted to make, Bill. But that's a really, when I saw that, when I heard that information being given out, the summation that, well, he was going to write a ticket because he didn't take his ticket book, I thought just the opposite based on my training. In other words, the last thing that I would ever do would make my initial approach with my hands busy with an extra item in the ticket book. That's just not smart. So no matter what your predisposition is to the traffic violation, you know what, I'm probably going to give this guy a warning, or let me get information because I'm going to give this guy a ticket, whatever it is, you leave that ticket book in the patrol car so you have all of your resources available to you on the initial approach.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. So I think in today's times, or in your times when you were in your early days, working the roads as a highway patrolman, I would think you would radio in the license plate as soon as you make a stop and say, like, I'm out with this car, or I'm mm-hmm. going to be out with this car with this license plate.
So it's a very, it's another point they raised there. Well, a little bit, they touched on that. Even, I see today, I've been gone, you know, from my patrol, but, mm-hmm. but even all the years I have patrolled, it wasn't an absolute that you're going to run every vehicle that you stop. In fact, the majority of vehicles that we stopped, that I stopped, you didn't run unless you had some type of a suspicion that there was something out of the ordinary. And you probably ran the plates more often after initial contact. People don't have their driver's license, their registration. You realize that, you know, or any number of things, you may go back to verify. And usually, again, I'm speaking of the Highway Patrol, you know, a few years later after this documentary, but often you would run things in tandem. You run the plate and a driver's license, and especially if someone's unlicensed like this. I'm sure this guy was unlicensed, Harry was unlicensed. You go ahead and run a driver's license and a license plate together to get the biggest picture that you could to take the appropriate enforcement action. So the fact that these officers, you know, again, there were two officers here, and neither one of them had felt there was a reason to run the plate. To me, that, in my training experience, it wasn't unusual.
Okay. Mark, what about, and it was not, it wasn't done in this case, but I've seen it done before, and I've heard an explanation, and I'm just curious if this was something that you did or patrolmen that you work with did. Walking up, you already said you generally would approach on the passenger side, but I've seen people approaching the driver's side and putting like their palm print or their fingerprints on the trunk of a car.
Yeah.
What's the purpose of that? Or was that a standard policy thing or just a preference of an officer?
Well, we were certainly trained for that. And one of the reasons you put the hand on it is you're checking for any movement, any vibration in the trunk, and to make sure that, you know, the person you see there is the only person, the persons that you see are the only people in the vehicle. Make sure the trunk is closed. So you push down there to make sure it's secure, that someone's not going to pop out and come from behind you. So there are a lot of reasons to do that. I will say this, and I did say that, you know, generally you make right-center approaches, but it was not an absolute, because in the worst, sometimes even on the freeway, someone pulls up, it's a narrow shoulder, they're right up against the sound wall. You simply can't fit between the sound wall and the right side. So you either try to get them off the freeway, or if you just can't for whatever reason, you have to make that left side approach. It's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, Bill, I had the preference myself when I made a traffic stop on the streets, especially depending on the street itself, a quiet neighborhood street, not so busy, you know, boulevard. I prefer to offset my vehicle to the left by a couple of feet and make left side approaches. Because for me, I felt that I had a tactical advantage. First of all, putting my patrol car in the way of traffic, it didn't eliminate, but it mitigated the risk of traffic to me. And I preferred the angle, so to speak, of approach. To me, it was more difficult for a potential threat, a threatening individual, someone who wanted to do me harm, to actually get a bead on me from that position when I have eyes on. Other officers felt that it was more difficult for them to turn over the right shoulder to the right side of the car. So that was my preference. And the Highway Patrol allowed us to make that determination ourselves, because we're the ones that have to view the totality of the traffic stop. So the officer making the left side approach there in that documentary, Wood, didn't seem, again, out of the ordinary to me.
Are you left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
You're right-handed. Okay.
I'm right-handed.
Interesting. Okay. So, you know, the shooting happens and the car flees the scene, and the Woods partner, the female officer, fires a number of shots. I don't know, 5-6 shots at the car, and they really don't have much. And that's where the case starts, right? This was, like I said, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. One thing that they made it a point of highlighting is that, you know, a month later, as Christmas is approaching, one of the detectives in the documentary says, hey, Christmas was approaching. We'd never had an unsolved police homicide go on this long. So pressure was mounting to make an arrest. And I think that played a little bit of a role in some of the events that happened down the road, right?
I do. I do. I think the pressure got to the police department, prosecutors, judge, community.
So David Harris, you know, the 16-year-old who stole a car, stole guns, went to Dallas. He's back in Vidor, Texas now, and he's bragging to people in the community, at least three of his friends that, or I shouldn't say friends, three people that they interviewed in the documentary. He had told each of them that he killed a cop in Dallas. He shot a cop. He said, I swear I shot a cop. And he was, fair to say, he was bragging about it, Mark, or very boisterous about it. You know, wanted everyone to believe that I guess adamant. He was adamant to people in the community that he knew that he had shot a cop. And he even showed one guy the gun that he said he used, the pistol that he said he used to shoot the cop. What happens then? Mark Harris is involved in some other crimes in the city, or they catch him for the stolen car, I guess?
Yeah, because it was a combination. It was a breaking, entering, burglary into the residence. And when you see Harris interviewed, I got to just say this, Bill.
Yeah.
I'm not a shrink. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist. But to me, if there was ever an example of a sociopath, it seems like to me it's Harris. Yep. In other words, the way he's interviewed a number of times, or there are a number of clips of him being interviewed throughout the documentary. And whether or not one is responsible for the murder of a cop or the murder of anybody, the way that someone responds to it in an interview, talks about it, to me is kind of indicative about their mindset. And this guy was completely, I mean, he was just cold, matter of fact, very, very kind, almost charming in some of his interviews, but it just seemed like he was detached from the seriousness of the situation. Yeah, so there's a burglary at a residence in Vidor, Texas, and the car stolen from that residence. He gets the keys and off he goes. But yeah, he I think there were three people, if I'm mistaken, tell me, Bill. I think there were three people in the documentary that were interviewed that said that he had told them individually that he had killed a cop. And he never said, by the way, and he never indicated to anybody else or to any of these people that there was anyone other than him in the vehicle.
Right. Good point. That's actually a real good point. And I guess the word had kind of got out in the city, or I don't know, you know, informants or how that worked. But the detective that seemed to have the most dealing with David Harris, Calvin Cunningham, it was interesting because he described Harris a lot like you just did, Mark, where he said, hey, nice guy, super polite. I never saw him really get angry in my dealings with him. But apparently, you know, from what we learned later, a cold-hearted killer, right?
Yep.
So when Cunningham's interviewing him, I guess Cunningham had a way of interviewing him, or felt he had a way of dealing with Harris, where Harris would tell a lie and Cunningham would just say, hey, we know that's not true. We know what you did. And Harris would say, you're right. Here's what happened, and, you know, kind of halfway confess. Well, Harris did take him to the gun, which he had put in the pond somewhere. I don't know if it was on his property or someone else's property, but he had wrapped the gun in a sock and oiled it up and put it in the water. And the Vidor detective got it out, recovered it. And, you know, so they confronted Harris and said, hey, you got the gun, you have this car. You're telling everybody you killed this cop. What happened? And that's when the story then changed, where although he had the weapon, the vehicle, he was bragging and telling everyone he did the crime. Then the story changes to Daryl Adams did the crime, and he was just in the car along for the ride, but he had nothing to do with it. An interesting kind of change of events there, Mark. And what was that? Would you say self-preservation or what?
Yeah, well, ultimately it was literally self-preservation. And, you know, beyond that, Bill, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but other than someone who, watch the documentary, there are a number of crimes that Harris commits or documented in the documentary. And it gives you a picture of, again, how I think detached he is from humanity And so, you know, the question people ask me, gee, Mark, how can someone do that? How can someone commit a crime like this and be like that? But what? I always tell them, I don't know. I'm not a criminal. I don't think like that. These are bad people. So, you know, why, other than self-preservation, which, by the way, I think is a great motivation if you've committed a crime. Beyond that, I don't know. I find it very interesting, Bill, and I'm glad you brought up the details about the gun. Because when it was revealed to what extent he went to protect the gun physically and threw it in this pond, I think it was a lake or a pond, to grease it up, oil it up, put it in a sock, things like this. I'm thinking, is he going to go back and retrieve it and use it again? And if that was your plan, why would you be so stupid when you know that you'd use this to commit the crime of murdering a peace officer? It's strange behavior. I mean, I've been taking care of guns for a long, long time in law enforcement. And it's like, well, he did a pretty good job. And when the detective said the gun was in pristine condition, it was going to be in pristine condition for a long time because he greased it up and oiled up so well. I don't know what to make of it, but I find it fascinating that he went to those lengths to protect that weapon. I don't know what was going on in his mind.
That's interesting. Yeah. And his story is that, we talked about it a little at the beginning. One thing he said that was interesting, though, because I guess the female partner had said there was only one person in the car, to her knowledge. So his story was that at the traffic stop, he ducked down in the passenger seat. And, you know, that made it appear like there was only one person in the car. And he says that after that, you know, he says Adams was driving. Adams did the shooting. I ducked down in the passenger seat. After the shooting, we went back to the hotel. And, you know, I tried to stay with him in the hotel room for the night. I had no place to stay. And he kind of left me hanging. And I left and eventually drove back to Vidor, Texas. Pretty much his story, Mark. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we're getting close to Christmas, they decide to pick up Daryl Adams. And, you know, this was interesting because actually this is kind of where the documentary starts, which is maybe why I went a little bit out of order here. But according to Adams, they're interviewing him and they basically bring in a confession and put it down on the table and tell him to sign it. And he says, no, I'm not signing any confession. He says, there's no way I'm signing a confession. I didn't do it. Interesting that, you know, there's some things that I always think are interesting whenever you're in this type of situation where, you know, how they phrased that, how these detectives phrased Adams' innocence claims. They said, well, he wasn't really angry about it. He was just adamant that he didn't do it. And right. He was just adamant that he didn't do it and had nothing to do with it. And I guess, I don't know, maybe no matter what your behavior is in this situation, there'll be someone out there who says that strange behavior.
Sure.
Yeah. So then Adams claims they put the gun on the table and they say, hey, take a look at this. And he takes a look at it and they say, pick it up. And he doesn't pick it up. He says, I'm not touching it. And he claims that the detectives draws his gun and points it at him and says, pick it up. And they have this standoff. He refuses to touch it. Mark, who knows if this is true or not? You know what I mean? But if it is true, obviously, I would guess they're trying to get his fingerprints on the gun or somehow connect him to the gun, which apparently they couldn't do. A little bit strange of a story. Again, 1976, who knows what was happening back then. But, you know, the thing about Adam's story is he's pretty specific about where he goes and what he does. And he talks about getting back to the hotel and watching the Carol Burnett show on TV and watching the beginning of the evening news. And it wasn't that late at night. You know, you think, what's that saying? Bad things happen after a certain time at night. I think it was 9:30.
Nothing good happens after midnight.
Yeah, nothing good happens after midnight. I want to say this was about 9:30 at night or something close to that. 9:30 at night, he was back in his hotel with his brother and apparently went to sleep. And I guess the murder happened, I don't know, 2 hours after that, according to him anyway.
I think it was 11:30, 11:45.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, Harris, the juvenile, he's about 2 hours off from Ramble Adams story about 2 hours later in everything, which is interesting because, in other words, as a detective, I mean, 2 hours, that's a big difference. And so this is a case where you're saying, okay, someone is, I'll just say, I'm not going to say anybody's lying or whatever. People can still not remember things. I understand that. But someone is way less accurate. And someone's probably much closer to being accurate with these stories here with a 2 hour difference. And when you have someone like Randall Adams, who can kind of back up where he was, his brother, they'll tell what he's watching, what was on TV, things like this. He has some things that can actually lock him into certain places or times, mm-hmm. at least way more than Harris does. So it's an example there where I'm thinking these cops have, you know, for whatever reason, we can talk about that, but they've already mm-hmm. kind of made their mind up about where this investigation is going to go.
Yeah. So, and that is, I think, where we're at next. But one question I have, and I don't know if this is getting a little ahead, but I'd like to get an answer. So his brother, you would think like, well, his brother can provide him an alibi, right? His mm-hmm. brother was in the hotel room and his brother originally said, I was here with him the whole night. But then his brother ended up not testifying at the trial mm-hmm. and really kind of not getting involved in it. And when I saw that kind of early in the show, when I saw that, I thought, oh, that's, you know, something's going on here. But I have a thought about that, but I'd like to hear what you think. Like, why do you suppose his brother would all of a sudden kind of, I don't want to say recant, but his brother did provide an alibi and then all of a sudden said, I'm not getting involved in this.
Bill, I was going to ask you that question. That was going to be one of the few times I'd say, Bill, I have a question for you. And that is a question for you. I don't have a good answer. I have speculation. Mm-hmm. And speculation is not a good answer. It's not a good thing without evidence, without something to back up your speculation. So mine is pure speculation. Yeah. My speculation is there was some force that intimidated him. Yeah. That's my speculation.
I would say the same thing. And here's the thing. I noticed he wasn't involved in the documentary. And who knows what the relationship is between Daryl and was at the time of the documentary, you know, because that's kind of a serious thing, but I would think that probably, and the documentary did made it sound like, here's what the documentary did say, that the thought was that if Adams were convicted and his brother had made some kind of statement that turned out to be proven false, that he would be an accessory after the fact or something to that effect. And I have to think that that played a part, some kind of threat of prosecution played a part in him making the determination not to get involved and provide an alibi for his brother. The other thing, Mark, and it gets to, I think, what you just touched on, which is, you know, hey, there's more or less only two suspects in this murder. The decision that the one prosecuted was going to be the adult. What is your experience? Because I know in the federal system, and I might have mentioned this to you before, in the federal system, minors are never charged. They are almost never charged. Like there is a mechanism for charging minors, but it's almost never done and it's extremely cumbersome. What is your experience with cases or arresting teenagers and how they're looked at in the judicial system? What thoughts do you have on that?
Well, I had very, very few instances where I ever investigated a juvenile, let's say somebody under 17. The 17, mm-hmm. at least when I was a cop in LA, that was still, you know, depending on the crime, they could still be prosecuted as an adult.
Right.
But let's just say under 17 years old, it was very, very rare. And the most of the cases I'm talking about that I was aware of involved in, they're, you know, probably homicide. I do know, remember one case in Los Angeles County, the station where I worked, we had a situation just like that, where an underage driver actually killed an elderly man driving 100 miles an hour on a surface street, his dad's Mercedes. Mm-hmm. And they actually charged him with second degree murder. I said it was a vehicular homicide, but second degree murder because of the enormously outrageous speed he was traveling. And then it got, you know, pled down to, I think, a felony manslaughter, and then resulted in virtually no jail time. So, but these are In other words, you have to investigate a lot of cases. And I mean, an LAPD detective, an LA County Sheriff's, you know, NYPD, things like this, to get a good cross-section on what happens to juveniles. I don't have that knowledge base, but I would say this. In a case, the same circumstances that we're looking at here, the murder of a cop by, I think you said 17, I was 16. I think he was 17, Bill. I think he was 17. Okay.
But maybe 17. He might have turned 17. I think by the time of the trial, he was 17.
Okay, so 16 years old when he committed it.
Yeah.
I think this is something like even in California, maybe even today in the Wright County, that you might get a prosecution, in other words, charged as a juvenile charged as an adult here, because mm-hmm. it's so egregious. But you know, having said that, that's why we have 58 counties in California. You have 58 different right. DAs. And that applies through all 50 states of the union. You're going to have a lot of different takes on this, a lot of different procedural standards. So it's just one of those things where the three words come into play here. I don't know.
Yeah. I know that it appears that for under Texas law, Harris would not have been eligible for the death penalty, mm-hmm. I guess.
Correct.
I guess even if he's charged as an adult, he could have got life in prison, but he would not have been eligible for the death penalty. And it sounds like maybe that played into it, or it was just, you know, because it's strange. You know, he had stolen the gun used in the murder. He had stolen the car that was used in the murder. Like all these, you know, the tools of the crime, so to speak, were attributable to him. And he's bragging about committing the crime. Yet when he's confronted, he just, you know, all he has to do to kind of exonerate himself is say, oh yeah, that, you know, I had the gun, I had the car. And I've been telling people I did it, but I really didn't do it. It was this guy that was with me. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the decision's made to prosecute that other guy who, by the way, has no criminal history at all.
Right.
You know, that's the other
thing.
As far
as we know.
Daryl Adams had no criminal history. So it could have come down to just not being eligible for the death penalty. And it could be at that point in time in that part of Texas with that prosecutor, they wanted to be able to do a capital murder case on someone who killed a cop. So I guess, you know, we get to Adams being charged. We talked about his brother not providing, you know, the alibi for him. It just seemed like we said, it seemed like he was afraid of just getting roped up into the case, and probably because of something that was said to him, I would guess. What about, you know, we've talked about this, Mark, eyewitness testimony, right? The testimony of the female officer. One point that was made, and I don't know, I'd like to get your opinion on how true this is. Adams says the best eyewitness statement is the one that happens 15 minutes after the event. In other words, this female officer, the partner, gave a statement shortly after, contemporaneous with the shooting, about what happened. And that, according to him, that statement was very different than what she testified to in court. Is there, do you think, truth to that? Because I know, like in the case of a critical incident, our policy was don't give a statement right away. We were afforded, I don't know, a number of hours to kind of decompress and, you know, assess and give a statement later. Like that was our policy. Is it something where you feel like a eyewitness statement is going to, you know, the first statement is the best statement? Or do you think things will slowly, you may slowly remember things down the road?
Well, I think that first of all, talking about the, you know, not being compelled to give a statement. We're talking about administratively in law enforcement, and you're involved in a critical incident. You're, you mm-hmm. know, an in custody death, which an officer involved shooting resulting in death would be, things like this. So these are different procedural, you know, elements of an incident we're talking about in that case. I will say this. I do believe that the most timely statements are generally the most accurate. Now, that doesn't mean that a statement down the road is not very accurate as well. And this is what a good investigator does. You look at the totality of the evidence, physical evidence, witness statements, things like this. I think one of the reasons that the difference between law enforcement being involved in a critical incident and you're going to have time to decompress, they're isolated generally. Now, isolated, they may have a representative with them, things like this. But they're not going to be talking to other people to have to cloud the recollection. If you mm-hmm. talk to another potential witness to the same incident, a civilian. They saw it, and you get a hold of them 3 days later. Now they've talked to everybody in the world. They've seen everything on television, potentially, things like this. They're questioning themselves. So their recollection, I think, is more easily clouded than someone who is sequestered from outside influences. I think it's the difference in those two examples or examples that you gave. So I do think that the most contemporaneous statement is most reliable under general circumstances.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that Adam said, he said that, yeah, she gave this statement initially 15 minutes after the shooting, and then after the IA investigation, weeks later, where they had, quote, refreshed her recollection, the statement was completely different. Just to give you an idea of some of the things that he said, and I guess it turns out to be somewhat significant, is at the time of the shooting, she said that, you know, one individual in the car was wearing a jacket with a fur-lined collar, right? And he says that that's the jacket Harris had on, and I think Harris even admitted that. He had like a Levi jacket with a fur collar on it, or some kind of jacket, a parka, actually, with a fur collar. Mm-hmm. And Adams just had a denim Levi jacket with a regular denim collar on it. And then at trial, she said, well, it could have been just bushy hair. And, you know, that's a little bit, you know, I don't know. That's significantly different whether you're talking about bushy hair or...
And by the way, Bill, to chime in there, is that, see, this is what I'm talking about recollections being influenced or clouded, because Adams did have bushy hair. And as she, at that point, she'd had, at the time of the shooting, he did. And of course, at that point, she'd had time to see photos of him.
Yeah.
I think during the trial, his hair was combed back. But So, again, this is a little speculation on my part, but, you know, question is, at that point, was she influenced by superiors, by peers? And then did she have a chance to, you know, rework her testimony to fit what had been put in front of her? I don't know the answer to it, but these are the questions that come up when you actually, you know, stretch out witness statements.
Yeah. So what's interesting is the defense attorneys thought the case was going pretty good for them. They thought that no one really believed Harris. They thought that they had a chance of winning the case. And then these, you know, the way they tell the story, they show up in court one day. And obviously, I don't think this is the way it would happen, because witnesses have to be disclosed ahead of time. But they show up in court one day, and there's three witnesses being sworn in. And all of a sudden, they're eyewitnesses to, more or less, to the crime. And what I think was the key part of this for me is, until there was a suspect, Mark, there were no eyewitnesses. Once there was a suspect who the police had identified, then all of a sudden there was three eyewitnesses. What do you think about those? And we'll get into some detail, but what are your general thoughts on those eyewitnesses?
Utterly, completely unreliable, unbelievable. And from my experience of making traffic stops late at night, the idea, and again, we can get some details, so I won't get ahead of this, but the idea that they could testify they saw what they saw from their position at that time of night, I just simply don't believe it.
Yep.
Period.
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you from your experience. I mean, is that even fathomable, that you could drive by and identify a driver like that and say that's the guy?
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. The fact that the female officer was able to identify this, you know, this kind of prominent collar from behind, to me, that's, I won't say extraordinary, but, and I think that her initial testimony was right. That was pretty significant. She was able to eyeball that. And that's what, you know, spotlights going into the car, because it's nighttime, you're in the dark, it's light up there. And to see that level of detail, that's pretty good, but it's understandable, because you should be focused on who's in the car. You should be, as an officer, looking for those types of details. But for a civilian driving by a traffic stop, and by the way, I'll say this, often that you have people driving by, traffic collision, crime scene. I can't say for sure, but
yeah.
A lot of times where they're looking at the red lights, looking at the lights flashing, looking at the patrol car, looking at the officers, they're not focused in on a person sitting in the car. It just isn't making sense to me, Bill.
Right. So the woman's name, the first witness that I'd like to talk about, her last name was Miller. She's the blonde woman in the documentary. And at trial, she was very specific. She said, you know, something to the effect, that's him right there. He shot the cop. Here's what's interesting about her. She said in the documentary that she always wanted to be a detective or a wife of a detective. And I got a quote here. And this kind of blew my mind. And I don't know, the filmmakers must have just been licking their chops when she said this, right? This is a quote. "It's always happening to me everywhere I go. You know, lots of times there's killings, there's anything, you know, even around my house, wherever. And I'm always looking or getting involved, you know, find out who did it or what's going on. I listen to people and I'm always trying to decide who's lying, who killed who before the police do. See if I can beat them." Now, you know, that's your eyewitness. That's your eyewitness to a capital murder, Mark.
It's somebody as a, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer, but from a prosecution point of view, I'm thinking, is this the best we can do? Not yep. only is a person not a good witness, to the contrary, to me, it seems like it would just invalidate the prosecution's case if, as a prosecutor, this is the best that you can do.
Yeah.
This is the uninvolved, objective party is going to come and put everything together. If you really wanted a conviction, you'd actually leave this person out and go right. with what you have there.
Right. Yeah, you can't rely on that witness. And I'm be honest, it's almost unethical. It is, let's say that, probably unethical to even rely on that witness. The other witness was one of the other witnesses was her husband. And I guess they were both booked for drunken disorderly at their home. And all of a sudden, when they got to the station, they somehow became witnesses to this murder. And also their daughter, this was one that, and Mark, I had to even watch this a couple times, and I'm not sure I even still understand exactly the connection here. But their daughter also had a case pending, some kind of burglary or some kind of robbery case.
Yeah.
That was dismissed in the same court with the same judge, right?
Yeah.
And that case was dismissed. She says the husband said that he didn't see anything because it was too dark. So, yeah, this was another interesting part, Mark. When this couple was testifying, someone in the community that worked with this woman, I guess, called the DA's office and said, this woman is completely unreliable. Her and her husband said that for the right price, he would say that he saw anything or whatever they wanted him to see. Am I right about that?
That's exactly what she said.
Right.
The other lady talking about this couple, yes.
Right. So.
She did not like them. She did not like them. I think rightly so, based on her experience. She said these are bad people. They're not ethical people. And, you know, in other words, but anyway, go ahead, Bill. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, and again, this is another part that I watched like three times. She initially picked the wrong person out of a lineup.
Correct.
I mean, what I saw her say was like, the first time I didn't get it right, but another witness had picked him out. Well, the other witness was David Harris, the guy yeah. trying to get himself out of a murder case. That's mm-hmm. the other witness that picked him out.
Yeah.
Right? So yes. so she didn't pick him out of a lineup, and I don't know if that was disclosed or not. That may or may not be the issue that came up later in an appeal. I don't know. Let's talk about the other witness, Mark, because this one was almost equally as bad. So he was a self-described individual that had total recall. He said that he could just remember names, he could remember faces, he could remember dates, he could remember everything. And then he went on to not even really be able to remember where the police car was parked, right? He said, you know, the police car was stopped behind him, and then he said, no. And now again, this isn't his testimony in court that I'm talking about. This is his interview in the documentary. So mm-hmm. did he say this in court? I have no idea. But at the time this documentary was filmed, he had actually very little recall about what happened. And he said, you know, the police officer stopped behind him. And then he said, well, did he stop in front of him? And he said, well, I don't, you know, he said, anyway, he was behind him, right? But, well, he had him stop. And then he said, you know, as he was approaching the car, he got up to the window and he got shot. And then he said, well, or was he not up to the window yet? I mean, did he just seem like he didn't really remember any of the facts at the time they were interviewing him here?
It seemed like he wasn't there, bottom line. I mean, in other words, I would have had a better time testified at 13 years old from California. In other words, all three of these are such bad witnesses.
Right.
But this actually is what kind of leads into the rest of the story about Dallas Police Department itself and the prosecutor. These are the worst witnesses I could imagine in this type of a case. Any case.
So Adams was found guilty, capital murder case, sentenced to death. Mark, at the beginning, you talked about, you know, maybe some of the other research you did and other reasons or reasons why this might have happened. What can you add to this before we talk a little bit about the appeals and what ended up happening?
Well, I found this fascinating when I read this article about Errol Morris, the producer of this documentary, creator and producer. He initially was out a psychiatrist, James Grigson.
Right. I forgot about him.
And James Grigson, the psychiatrist, he had testified about 100 times in death penalty cases about the person convicted of a capital crime. And again, this person is subject to death penalty if a qualified psychiatrist can testify this person, if ever released, would ever engage in similar behavior. And again, it says 100 times that he testified that every one of these people convicted of a capital crime, if released, would engage in this type of behavior again, which in Texas, that's what gave the green light to sentence him to death.
Right.
100 times. So Errol Morris, the producer of this documentary, Thin Blue Line, had heard about him. And again, his name was called Dr. Death because he never ever testified to the contrary. So they said, if this guy testifies about your mindset, you're going to the electric chair, period.
Right.
So when he was researching the psychiatrist, one of the cases that he was exploring was this particular case. He ended up finding this particular case more compelling than the general behavior or history of the psychiatrist. And that's how we got to this particular documentary.
Right.
If you don't mind, I'll go on with the psychiatrist. Yeah. In the documentary, Adams, who's now been convicted of this crime, talks in the documentary about being interviewed by Grigson, the psychiatrist. And it pretty much, he said, from beginning to end, the total time that he was in front of me was about, he said, maybe 25 minutes, I believe he said, something like that. He comes in, he gives me some you know, diagrams and shapes and blah, blah, blah. And he wants me, and there's a line underneath these shapes, you know, like a triangle and a circle and a square and blah, blah, whatever. And so a line below that, and he wants me to recreate some wavy lines. He wants me to recreate those images on the second half of the piece of paper below. And the, you know, Adam says, you know, okay, I just want to make this clear. What you want me to do is just to copy what I see down here. Yep, whatever. And I'll be back. And he left the piece of paper. He goes out. He comes back with a cup of coffee like 15 minutes later. And I give him the piece of paper. And he asks me a couple of things and he leaves.
Yeah.
And then the same doctor now, he testifies in the sentencing portion of this trial that this person is a threat. And that was the green light to have him sentenced to death.
Yep. He said he was like Charles Manson.
Yes.
Compared him to both Charles Manson and Adolf Hitler. And a couple of the questions he asked him, according to Adams, were, what does the term a rolling stone gathers no moss mean? That was one of the things. And then, I don't know, there was a second one. I'm not remembering what it was, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, by the way, Bill, if the doctor had asked me anything about a rolling stone, I'd have gone to the gas chamber or electric chair, because I would have said, well, I love Brown Sugar. It's one of my favorite songs from Rolling Stones.
Right.
And, you know, it's a great one. So I'd have been screwed. But anyway, kidding aside, we can move forward.
Yeah. So there was an appeal filed, and interestingly, Texas Court of Appeals voted 9-0 in favor of the state, right? Mm-hmm. And it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court went 8-1 in favor of the defendant. Mm-hmm. Now, how arrogant was the judge, Mark, in this case, who took the two, the 9-0 and the 8-1, and totaled them together and said on camera he feels like he still won 10-8?
Yeah, it's scary. Yeah. When I saw that, I didn't know what to make of it other than what you said, just arrogance and dismissal of reality.
Yeah. Strange, you know, that whole interview with the judge was very strange. And listen, I'm going to be honest, probably that's why it was left in the documentary, because it didn't really add too much to the story with him telling the history about, was it his father or his grandfather was an FBI agent?
And he I believe it was his grandfather.
When Dillinger was.
Yes. And they're telling the whole story there about, it wasn't actually a red dress. It was an orange dress with the lights.
Almost,
and I'm not sure where that came from, where I was there.
Yeah, just kind of, I don't know. Yeah. Didn't have much to do with the story, but kind of showed a little bit about the judge. Maybe he's more interested in telling a story than actually doing his job.
Well, I think the reason that Morris left it in there might have been to indicate, hey, this guy is not all there.
That's right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying, right? I think that's definitely it. So the interesting thing is now, when, just so people understand, when anytime there's, like, let's say in this case, a Supreme Court reversal, that doesn't mean that the defendant's set free and he's found, the Supreme Court's finding him, quote, not guilty. Mm-hmm. What that means is there was some kind of procedural error and the case is remanded and they have the opportunity to try the case again. Now, in this case, this particular appeal was just with respect to the death penalty phase of the case. So what happened is the DA swore up and down, you know, cop killers don't go free here, which I completely understand. And he said, we're going to retry this case and we'll get a conviction again, et cetera. And then what did he do in reality, Mark?
He let it go.
He asked the governor to commute it to a life sentence. And
yeah.
So they didn't have to retry the case. Correct. So that's what happened. Then it was commuted to a life sentence.
With good reason, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was commuted to a life sentence and there was not going to be a retrial then. What I thought was fascinating is, you know, they played kind of, as we're getting near the end of the documentary, and they played one of the last interviews with Harris. And they talked about, you know, they asked Harris, like, hey, you know, what do you think of Daryl Adams' luck? And he said, man, if it wasn't for bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. And basically, they went back and forth with Harris, and they asked Harris, like, how did Adams get in this situation? Something to that effect was the question. And basically what Harris said was, if I had had a place to stay that night, this whole thing might not have never happened, mm-hmm. you know? So, you know, they asked Harris, well, do you think he's innocent? And he basically said, yeah, I think he's innocent. And they say, why do you say that? He said, I'm the one who would know. Yeah. And so what it sounded like was, Harris helped Adams by, as I said in the very beginning, saw him walking on the side of the road with a gas can, stopped, picked him up, took him to get gas for his car and helped him out. And that night, Harris was looking for a place to stay. And according to him, Adams said, let me check with my brother, see if you can stay here in the hotel with us. Went in the hotel room, never came back out and left Harris hanging. And Harris made it sound like that's the reason why Adams was blamed for the crime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also the fact that Harris said, hey, I was a 16-year-old kid. I didn't want to get life in prison for, you know, for the murder of a police officer. Is that in line with what you saw there?
Yeah, that's exactly how I saw it.
Yeah. Interestingly, Harris, you know, basically he was on a crime spree, you know, around the time of this murder, he was on a crime spree, had done a bunch of other crimes, had a bunch of other cases pending. I guess the deal with him was a lot of that was dropped to get him to testify against Adams, went on to murder somebody else, get the death penalty for that. And he was actually put to death, I think, in 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
So he was actually, he ended up killing someone else, getting the death penalty and being put to death. So wrapping it up, Mark, You know, we get to another appeal. And that's kind of, by the way, that's where the documentary ends, right?
Yeah.
The documentary kind of ends there. It brought attention to this case. And here's a piece from, you know, a news story that came out about a year later. In 1989, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in Ex parte Adams overturned Adams' conviction on the grounds of malfeasance by the prosecutor, Doug Mulder, and inconsistencies in the testimony of a key witness, Emily Miller. That was the blonde lady who we spoke about. The appeals court found that prosecutor Mulder withheld a statement by Miller to the police that cast doubt on her credibility and also allowed her to give perjured testimony. Furthermore, the court found that after Adams' attorney discovered the statement late in Adams' trial, Mulder falsely told the court that he did not know the witness's whereabouts. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals stated that conviction was unfair mainly because of prosecutor Doug Mulder. Mulder had returned to practicing private law in Dallas in 81. Following the appeals court decision, the case was returned to Dallas County for a retrial, but the district attorney's office declined to prosecute the case based on the length of time since the original crime, and Adams was subsequently released. Despite being wrongly imprisoned for 12 years, Adams received no compensation from the state of Texas. It is said that if Adams had been found to be wrongly convicted under present-day Texas law, he would be entitled to receive $80,000 for each year of incarceration. Additionally, at the time his conviction was thrown out, wrongly convicted prisoners could get a lump sum of $25,000 if pardoned by the governor. However, since Adams was released because his case was dismissed and not because he was pardoned, he received no payment from the state after his release. So he ended up winning an appeal. And as I said, that doesn't mean he's not guilty, right? It doesn't mean there's a finding of innocence. It just means that they go back to square one and the case is remanded and they have the opportunity to try the case again. And the state just said no thanks, and he was set free. I don't know. Were you aware of that, Mark? That he had won an appeal eventually?
Yeah, I was aware of that, and okay. And also in the article I read, same thing about the $80,000 a year under current law. But you know, he won the appeal, which obviously is huge. But of course, his life was ruined.
Yeah,
and then he subsequently died at a relatively young age. I think it was a brain tumor,
cancer,
or some kind of cancer.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's just tragic, and not to mention the fact, we talked about OJ, I think it was our last show, Bill.
Yep.
And, on the books, I guess technically now, Officer Cook's murder is unsolved. I would imagine that that's how it is, since he was, I don't know, again, if he was found not guilty or if he was just, the case was just thrown out. But those things, especially something like this, with O.J. Simpson, where a videotape couldn't have brought as much evidence against O.J. as was presented in the trials, where I'm concerned. This one, not quite as much evidence, but anybody looking at this objectively knows that this kid, and again, by his own statement, like you said, at the end of the documentary, I think you said, I would know or I know, but either way, he said, I'm the only person who would know that Adams didn't do it. Well, how is that possible? That means you had to be there. So it leaves a lump in my stomach when something like this happens and we know who the perpetrator is and they're not brought to justice. It's one thing if something is truly unsolved and those things happen, unsolved. You never get a suspect, you never get a good suspect, you just don't have enough evidence. But cases like this, this is what places prosecutors or certain communities, cultures in a really, really bad light when things like this happen. And this is one of those cases.
Yep.
By the way, go ahead, finish.
No, go ahead.
The title of Thin Blue Line, there's a lot more to this documentary and there's a lot more to this overall story. And one of this goes back to that town, Vidor, Texas, a little tiny town there.
Yep.
It was the head of the Ku Klux Klan in Texas.
Yes, sir.
Initially, the reports that the Dallas officer that was killed was black.
Yep.
There was a lot of push. There was a lot of, at that point, like from that town, almost nothing really bad happened. It was just a black cop, whatever. And so I think from the onset, there was a culture here. It wasn't Dallas Police Department per se. They were certainly the tools of whatever sentiments were floating around the community. But this was really organic, that the thin blue line, it wasn't necessarily protecting other cops. It was kind of protecting a culture at that time, Bill. I mean, this is the way I see this. It was kind of a bigger picture than we think of the thin blue line now, where, you know, it's the lines between anarchy and rule of law. And that's the thin blue line of cops. This was something, I think, bigger and really more organic than that at the time. And the fact that they wanted to make sure someone got the death penalty for this, and they couldn't do it with Harris because it was a juvenile, that's part of that culture. Someone's going to pay for this, and we don't care who it is, but someone's going to pay for it. And this guy can't because of his age. So, oh, listen, this person's implicated. We'll get this guy and go. And so when I read this thing, when I see that thin blue line, I think about what it meant then as to what I think it means now.
Yep. I think you're 100% right, that's a huge part of what was behind it. And scary, when the defense attorneys talked about going to Vidor, Texas, everybody in the community knew they were there. Everybody in the community knew why they were there and knew what, at one point the lawyer tells a story about being at this hotel and looking for the hotel room where the other lawyer was staying. And someone in the parking lot says, well, if you're looking for that lawyer from Dallas, they're in room, 233 or whatever it was. The community knew, who they were, why they were there. And that's a little bit scary. And that's, it's 1976. That's not that, that's not like it's 1956, Mark,
No, it's not that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that things have changed. I think things have changed way for the better. But we all have to be honest with ourselves and with each other. And I think that this was a big influence in 1976.
100%. 100%. I think today, with technology, with tighter police procedures, body cameras, dash cameras, et cetera, this case is a totally different case. And hopefully some of that technology and just better policing, can prevent something like this from happening again. But a scary story, and the tragic story of a death of a police officer. And one thing we didn't mention, Mark, is how gut-wrenching is it to remember, this is Thanksgiving weekend, to hear that his wife had bought him a bulletproof vest and was going to give it to him for Christmas, a month later.
It is absolutely gut-wrenching.
Yep. Just because back in these days, I mean, not everybody had, there wasn't bulletproof vests issued, right?
Nope. No, even when I came on, they weren't required. You weren't required to wear them when I first started, which I put mine on. I wore mine in the shower. but it wasn't required until even after a couple of years, after I came on, that, you had to.
That's shocking. That's shocking. For the 90s, I feel like that's shocking that it wasn't required. But then again, I think in the 90s, some departments still used revolvers, six-shot revolvers.
Right? Yeah. Well, I was the first in the first class, the first graduating class from the academy to carry semi-automatic. My seniors in the academy, the cadets that started 3 months before I did, they were still carrying revolvers.
Yeah.
And so, when I reported, I had a 40 caliber, semi-automatic sidearm, and my field training officers were still carrying revolvers. So, like you said, these things aren't that long ago.
Right. Well, let me end it, Mark, with a quote from Randall Adams. And this is, he spoke somewhere after he got out, after he won his appeal and got out. He said, "The man you see before you is here by the grace of God. The fact that it took 12 and a half years and a movie to prove my innocence should scare the hell out of everyone in this room. And if it doesn't, that scares the hell out of me." I think that kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
Right. All right, Chief, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week.